Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Conversations, a program about food in all its aspects, from planting seeds to eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shoe Swap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shoe Swap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. Today, again, we have three important guests in the food scene in the Shoe Swap. Brad DeMille, who's co-owner with his wife Kelly of DeMille's Farm Market. David Askew, who's president and owner of Askew's Foods. And Dave Wallace, who's the operations manager for the Salmon Arm and Armstrong Askew stores. Welcome, everybody, to Food Conversations.
Thank you
for having us.
Morning.
Gentlemen, I wanted to start today. On our last show, we talked about the trajectory that each of you had followed to get into and seriously embedded in the food sector. Today, I thought we could focus more on how we can change the system here to enhance food sovereignty for the people who live here and for the people who work here. And I thought a place to start might be to look at the impact of adversity on somebody who is looking at something like food sovereignty, because you're all involved in it. If you took all the expertise you guys have in food retail, you could probably build a mountain out of it. You guys have seen so much that's gone on here over the years. But each of you has also had to deal with adversity. Dave, when you were a young fella, the bottom fell out of the market and you guys lost, as it were, the farm. Which is an incredibly difficult thing to deal with. Even as a young person, you could sense it. Brad, you had the same phenomenon. As you said, the bank took away a large chunk of your land, and you guys had to rebound from that decisively harmful experience. And David Askew, came back to a well-established family business, but right around the time you came back in 2007 was a time when Smart Centers was building a giant shopping center, open format shopping center, what we call a big box store shopping center, just outside of Salmon Arm, and you had to make some important decisions about that. So I want to ask each of you to comment on what it's like to go through an adversity experience like that, how it shapes your perspective on what you do next. Dave, why don't you start to tell us about that?
I think actually it probably makes you appreciate a dollar a little bit more and how hard it is to come by that dollar and how hard it is to lose that dollar. And whether that makes a person a little more thrifty as he goes about his daily life, I don't know. But, I tend to take the safe road a lot in my choices in life. And it's worked out well. But I believe that probably was shaped a lot by how I grew up.
Do you ever see the specter of that experience kind of in the background, like knowing that things can go off the rails if you're not paying attention, that kind of thing?
Oh, yes, for sure. An example might have been how what you just mentioned to David Askew about the Walmart and the Smart Center opening up on the other end of town. You know, that could be a huge disruption, and it probably was for a lot of businesses in town.
I remember at the time there's a lot of discussion in the community about the impact of the two polar opposite stores, if you like, in terms of the location. Brad, your family farm and subsequent retail operation was really challenged when the interest rates were high and the economic situation was really hard, and you ended up losing a large chunk of land. How did that impact on you, both personally in terms of being a business person?
Well, at the time I was quite young and kind of, again, ignorant of economics. And as a young kid at 18 or 19, they don't really teach you that in school at the time. And they certainly don't do that now. The value of the dollar and how to handle a dollar and how hard it is to come by. One of the downsides of school is they really don't teach you economics of a simple dollar, how to make it, how to keep it, and the power of it. It seems a little bit remiss on our on that part of it, to learn the value of the dollar the hard way of running out of it. It taught us a couple things, that you had to be frugal with what you had. And we had very little, even though it seemed like we had a lot. I think we had better credit. I had a conversation with a young fellow the other day. I said, I think we have the same amount of money. I just have better credit. and there's a lot to be said for learning not to mess that up, because these days that tracks you almost your entire life. If you start messing up with credit, it's difficult to fix it. And if the only biggest advice I can give the young people, get a small loan or a credit card, but don't use it, and always pay it off and just build up those points. And that, for us, we came back from a very low credit rating to an ability to be in a position of good credit now. And it's taken 30, 40 years to recover from that.
That's quite a challenge. Do you find yourself, and it's obvious Dave said this, that you kind of look back over your shoulder sometimes and wonder, are things going the way you want them and need them to go?
Well, you always question your decisions, and hopefully you make one better decision than your last worst decision. I think that might define success, is having one more win than losses. And I think these days, in those days, we had more losses than wins, and that ended up to be a death blow. But what was interesting is the challenge that we were seeing also was not any different than the other folks in the town had to accomplish also, or to deal with, because they were looking at ways to save money.
So they were sharing your burden also.
Exactly. What happened was we were able to supply food at a lower cost to them, where they were looking to save money. So by an opportunity of almost losing everything, we were given an opportunity to supply and actually fill a little need and recognize it. And the biggest thing is you recognize that need. I don't want to quote a movie, but if you see a need, fill a need. I think it was on a cartoon or Pixar or something. But there's absolutely that. And if you see an opportunity, a lot of people are just blinded by their day-to-day 9-to-5 job. As an entrepreneur and as someone that runs a business, I typically see, I have no blinders on.
David, you arrived and took over the central role in Askew's Foods when the situation was a little bit iffy. You had a much more long-standing family business, large family, et cetera, firmly embedded in the community. But that must have presented you also with some issues about timing, about financing, about loans, about, you know, all the things that you need to do to make a big change in the structure of the business. What did that do for you in terms of that time with Askew's?
Well, you know, when I think, when you raise the topic of threats to the business, when I was growing up, the threat was always that Safeway would come to town. We were a storefront on Alexander at that time, where On Alex is now. And the threat was that Safeway would come to town and put us out of business. And, you know, what did happen in, like, earlier on in the 50s, in late 50s, early 60s, was the first supermarket came mm-hmm. to town. That was a Shopeasy, a Super Value on the highway, and that's a Weston affiliate. And the storefront, without the parking and so on, became an obsolete idea. And so my father really faced a serious problem then, which was, how was he going to respond to the, you know, to the introduction of supermarkets to Salmon Arm? And that's when he started looking to build his own supermarket. And that was the big risk that the business took, was to do that. Sure. And to establish the shopping center on what was Front Street on Lakeshore. And, you know, that paid off and that worked out. But the other thing was that, like I say, we were being supplied by Weston at that time. So and then later on, we changed suppliers. But what you find now is that all of the independents pretty much are being served by the wholesale arms of the big players. And I think, you know, in the long run, that's, you know, the really significant issue for independents, is that they're being supplied by their competition.
It's an interesting dilemma that faces, from what you're saying, every food retailer in a community. Now, Brad, you made reference to the fact about credit rating. What I interpreted that to mean to some degree is trust and a sense of respect in the community. Does that sort of, the credit rating is a numerical kind of, you know, calculate, an actuarial calculation, but ultimately it means a question of trust within the community. Did you feel that regaining credit rating also meant regaining a trusted position in the community, which Dave is talking about as well?
Well, absolutely. And I think a lot of it was built on a level of distrust, because in the banking times, it was brutal, man. They would come in and it wasn't very localized. The decisions were made in a head office somewhere else that had no personality and no real regard for what your needs were.
Yeah.
Most of what Dad and my mom went through was self-financing, eking out enough living to self-finance improvements and doing stuff that made it work. And it took a long time, at least 10 years for them to get, you know, to a point where you could be trusted, like their credit union lends money, but probably they have a certain level of trust that their members own the credit unions. And they have to know that they're going to get paid back. It is a business and it's interest. They have to know that their loan to you is safe.
Indeed,
and
they
their
do.
Money.
Indeed, they do. It's interesting, Dave, on our last show, you talked about the difference between dealing with these large-scale distributors, and that it was quite a different experience when you talk to, say, the Pepsi representative versus, say, local farmers and local producers. Just characterize that difference that goes on between a representative of a large food distributor and somebody who's a local farmer. It's a qualitatively different experience.
Oh, most definitely. And when you're dealing with someone like Coke or Pepsi, it's almost that you have to play by their rules. It's not a partnership, you know. It might be a partnership on maybe a few agreed spots to put their product or their coolers in your store. But when you switch over to dealing with a local supplier, it is a partnership. And it's usually most enjoyable, actually. Quite often, we will go to the farms and meet them, or have a meeting in January where, hey, this is what I've got coming available in May, June, July. What would you like me to plant this year? What are you seeing a shortage of down from Mexico or California? And for instance, the local HASCAP grower in Armstrong, you know, I've got this great product, but a HASCAP plant is picked once and then that's it. I'm going to freeze it. You know, how can Askew's Foods, you know, take advantage of what I have? And so we have contacts in the business where I reached out to some packaging companies, got them to get a hold of him. What does he need for labeling? Put on his labeling, and now we're carrying his product, and it's moving along quite nice.
Exactly. The word partnership came into my mind just a second before you said it. We're starting to talk a little bit about trust and relationships in the community. David, over the years, clearly Askew's has established a firm presence, not just in Salmon Arm, but in the area. When you watch the relationships evolve with local producers, what do you see as a difference between what you described earlier as a threat coming from SuperValu coming to town, seeing it as a direct competition and potential taking away of market share? How do you see the relationship between those large players and your local producers that you're increasingly incorporating into your retail chain?
Well, you know, we have a wide range of local suppliers. They range from someone bringing in, you know, a few pounds of green beans to a supplier like the Dutchman Dairy in Sicamoose, which can really supply Askew's in the same way that Saputo or one of the other big companies can supply us. So we do have a wide range. I think to some extent it's the personal relationships you know the families, you know, who established it. You knew the parents. Now you know the next generation that's running it. And so you have more of a personal connection, and the decisions are being made by those people, not by a large corporate head office.
So you can talk to them. You can talk to them much more and have a more intimate interaction with them, because you work on the parameters that you're dealing with and they work on their parameters in a more open way. That would be fair to say.
I think what Dave said about the Haskap berry is a good example. You can work with a producer to develop a product that you need. I mean, when we had the meat plant, my father spent a lot of years developing a supply of hogs from the Armstrong area. You can try to work on those things. And I think what's happening now is that people, the customers, are really interested in local food, so that it gives an incentive for producers like strawberries, raspberries. And for us, like, we bring in peaches, and I know the Mills does the same thing from the Okanagan, and those are really popular and sought after products that we have that the big chains don't tend to have.
Brad, you talked on our last show about 150 producers that you have relationships with who bring food to you. Obviously, that's, we're talking about the heart and soul of a locally embedded food system. Why don't you just walk us through the process whereby you engage a producer? Say, new guy comes in, and how do you find out about him, and what do you do when you meet him or her? Everybody listening to the show should know that young women farmers are the largest growing demographic in the agricultural community in British Columbia. So let's say her. A young woman comes to your store and says, I produce rutabagas in large quantities. Would you be willing to sell them? Okay, take it away, Brad DeMille.
Well, typically what happens is a young lady came in about 2 years ago and brought me the crookedest long English cucumbers you'd ever think to imagine. So giving her some advice on don't grow those, that's the wrong variety, and guiding them to grow stuff. And again, Dave mentioned this, grow stuff to your market size. Don't grow it and then go look for the market, because the only one that has the power then is the person who might buy your product. And typically you'll go right down to the bottom dollar and nobody makes money. Mm-hmm. And typically it's not that great a product. Don't plant an acre of sugar snap peas. It's you're going to have an acre of peas all at once in the market. It's not big enough to capacitate your volume. You'll lose money and you'll not have very fun with it.
So do you actually talk to people about things like succession planting, you know, like how they do their farming work? Because you have lots of experience in the farming.
Absolutely. I mean, timing a product. When you go to a farmer's market, let's say ideally they think they can produce, I'm going to have this much product for Tuesdays, Fridays, and beyond Saturday. It just doesn't work like that. It's a gamble. Every time you put a seed in the ground, the weather's going to hit. You got a forest fire. You got a wind. You got a traffic jam. There's just so many variables to get you back to that market. And this is where the non-confidence in what they do is. If you can instill a confidence in them that they have a market for them for 7 days a week, it just goes a long ways in building a actual business, not a little hobby. And a lot of these folks can do it on 20 by 30 piece of dirt in their backyard that's largely organic. And don't plant grass. Everyone's got enough grass. And honestly, it doesn't take much to do a squash plant or a pumpkin that'll overshadow the weeds. And it's really not that hard, but it just takes a little bit of confidence. And if you can have that conversation with them to instill that they have an avenue for their product, that will give them the confidence to get out there and try it.
David, Brad, that's that you're describing human beings getting along with each other and getting to know each other, which is the essence of how you make a community. David, your operation is larger and you're dealing of necessity with some large scale distributors. And just for everybody to understand the scale of these large scale distributors, Kraft Canada, $13.46 billion in 2017 revenue, 10% of Kraft's global sales. Saputo, which is a dairy distributor from based in Montreal, it's about 70 years old, $14.9 billion in sales. It has operations from the United States to Argentina to Australia and all around the world. McCain Foods, also large scale, $7 billion, 22,000 employees. These are operations that are gigantic, but they're ability to relate to their producers is either very limited or nil. David, when you have producers come to you, obviously Dave would be, I guess Dave, you would be the, as the operations manager, you would deal with it. But your, David, your overall perspective on enhancing that pathway, if you like, into ASCUs, what's your sentiments on that notion?
Well, the thing is that with the very large manufacturers, they used to have representatives who came around to the stores and talked to the individual store managers about what they needed in their store and how to display it, and gave us, you know, incentives to build as many displays as possible with their product and so on and so forth. That's really changed quite a bit in recent years. So they prefer to deal, you know, through a wholesaler. So our main wholesaler is AG Foods, which is a Pattison Food Group company. And so we're dealing a lot with the supplier is our or the distributor is our wholesaling company, and then we're dealing with the individual companies themselves on incentives and so on. And Dave could tell you more about that and how that works.
Dave, why don't you just cut in here and give us an idea of what the process is.
As far as dealing with those larger companies, the ones that we have the best, whether we want to call it success or luck with, are the ones that have the best communication with us. And like David mentioned, we don't see the foot traffic coming in like we used to from, say, a Kellogg salesman or a General Mills salesman. Foot traffic, squeaky wheel, it gets the business done, and you're more up to make a purchase or a buy with them. But as far as the success we have dealing with the larger companies, it is the communication. And when they are able to communicate with us, offer an incentive, a rebate program, you know, if you meet certain purchase goals, that is the most productive way to deal with those larger companies.
Now, you mentioned the phrase purchase goals. That's a target that the large-scale distributor says, we'll be watching you to see if you sell enough of our food up to a certain point. And what, to me, that sounds like a bit of a, not so much a threat, as just a very practical statement on the part of the large-scale distributor that they're watching you carefully to see if you're a valuable market from their point of view. And what would happen if, say, your target sales drop below a certain target that they've established for you? What kind of reaction do you get from that distributor?
For the most part, actually, you would get some involvement with them. They would try to help the situation.
Okay.
They would try to work with you. What can we do? What can we offer you? Can we have more items available for your flyer, perhaps? Or can we work with your deli departments to supply, say, cheese, for example, for your pizza program, and what price looks good to you, and just to make that relationship work better. And when they're wanting us to make the purchases, and of course, it is beneficial for us to reach and attain a certain level, whether it be Coke or Pepsi or Saputo.
Right. When you have those kinds of conversations, qualitatively comparing them to, and we've done this already, but just to refresh people's memories, when you're talking to local producers, it's a much more flexible, informal, sort of personal process, right?
Oh, definitely. And as Brad alluded to, there's a great back and forth going on as to what would you like me to grow? I have this. How much of it do you think you will be able to purchase from me next year? We'll help them out with price point, you know, that sweet spot where us as the retailer are successful, they as a producer are successful, and they're again for us, they are there next year for us again as well. You know, there's no use trying to browbeat a local producer down to a price point to serve yourself if they're not going to be there next year or even finish off this year.
Thanks, Dave. That's interesting. David, when you're looking at this scenario of large-scale distributors who are the people you talk to now, how much do you have a sense that you can move in the retail sector into a deeper and broader engagement with local producers without necessarily compromising your relationship with the larger distributors? They're two different systems. The local system, which is intimate, personal, more enjoyable, obviously. Dave has made that clear, and so has Brad. The enthusiasm that you express for that is clear indication that it's a much more congenial kind of process. What do you sort of see as the way forward to balance the weight, if you like, the gravitas of this large food scale industry versus the growing, and it is growing, interest in local and more personalized and trust-based food systems?
Well, the thing is that, like, we have, say, in the Shuswap, we have at least a couple of manufacturers or bakers of crackers, and we sell them in the stores, and it doesn't really conflict with the sale of, you know, large-scale Christie's or whatever the large-scale manufacturers of crackers are, because the local producer is a small specialty niche. So our wholesaler isn't going to get worried about us selling those crackers. But you get into some other areas like yogurt and so on, where more they would tend to offer you, and in all areas really, offer you incentives to sell more of their product. And if they can offer you incentives, you make a higher margin and so on and so forth. It would offer those incentives. In some cases, they'll offer you incentives if you narrow down your selection so that their product brand takes a higher percentage of your sales. So they're working on it through those kind of angles.
Would it be fair to say that the pressure that comes from large distributors and the large-scale corporations behind them is basically around sales volume? I mean, that's the primary pressure, not so much having a congenial relationship with them or being able to have a discussion with them. There are sort of more hardline divisions between, you know, the volume is not going well, we want to change over to this product line. I mean, I know everybody's concerned about that. Everybody has said that, Brad and Dave in particular, because of your own personal experience, seeing how market forces can have a huge impact, sometimes negative impact on what you're doing. Our conversation is tending towards a discussion of relationships. And just from the tone of all of your voices, I hear this notion that it's very satisfying to deal with local people because you can have a meaningful conversation with them. You can go through a lot of different parameters. Back to you, Brad, to talk about the process, just sort of outlining from A, B to C to Z, as this person with a very crooked-looking cucumber approaches you and you say, "No, that won't work." And then you have a conversation, and then you work out an agreement with them. Tell us about the agreement, the kind of arrangement you have between yourself and one of the local producers.
Well, typically what happens is a lot of times economics of it aren't that on top of their mind. They think that their product's worth a dollar, that we could sell it for a dollar, but there's got to be some margin in the store. You have labor costs, your fixed heating, insurance, all the other stuff that we need to actually pay for. And there's an understanding of that volume helps fix that drop. Let's say they drop 20 points, or you'd sell just for 80. We sell it for a dollar or a dollar 29, whatever it is. But we take the risk of that. And this is where the transfer of ownership is that we buy this fresh product. We own it. We take the risk. This is why we make need to make some margin on it. And it's honestly exhausting talking to new people. And the more new people you talk to, it's exhausting. You have to have the right point person on that, because if they're a little slow in the uptake as far as understanding the economics of their new business they're in, it's hard. And explaining it, and it's expensive for them, especially if they planted half an acre or something that has no chance of selling. Let's say rutabagas, for instance. I don't know if there's a ton of success growing that kind of product. Where we're going to be successful is showing them products that maybe in their mind they think it's worth less. Like a carrot used to be worth 69 cents. Honestly, we're selling carrots now, these beautiful baby carrots, for like $3 to $5 a pound now. And you have to learn where that market, what it will bear. Again, Dave said that sweet spot. Is it too expensive? Is it in the wrong location? Is it priced too high? Is it priced too low? There's things. This is our job to do that thinking for them. And there's always a reason why something doesn't sell. And it's not always the product. It's typically could be the company. It's where it's at the till. Everyone wants their product at the till. That's great. You just need more tills. Sure.
Give me more exposure. More exposure.
And their market share, which is a lot of these bigger companies want their market share. And that keeps a lot of the competition down. For years, we've always struggled with, that DeMille's, it's a boutique market. It is true that we do have expensive products because of these guys that are making one-offs and like the very small batches of them. That in itself is a better product. I'm not saying it's worth more, but it just costs more to make. It's just as simple as that. And we have products that are super cheap, like our bargain rack. But and we always want a fair shot at it, because Askew's and ourselves, we share a lot of the same fresh produce customers, and we're always balancing. It's a very friendly competition. Dave and I have a good rapport. David, well, I'm not so sure of. Just kidding. We all know that we're in this community together, yeah. And I honestly think we make each other better.
Well, speaking of that, David, outside your store every Wednesday in afternoon in the summer, and outside your store every 2 weeks in the winter, there's an organic market. And the organic market, of course, is entirely supplied by local producers. My understanding is that it's had an impact on sales in the Askew's Uptown store. In other words, there's a synergy that's developed there.
Yeah, and it's pretty interesting, because the organic market used to be at the church up the road, and I happened to run into the people that were running the organic market at the church in the clubhouse at the Larch Hill Ski Club. And she said, "What do you think about, you know, us locating on your parking lot?" And it, you know, it has high exposure, highway exposure, and there's a large group of people coming to shop at Askew's, so it provides the traffic. So anyway, I broached that. I thought it sounded positive to me. Our produce people were a little leery of inviting the competition into the parking lot. So what we did was we had a 6 or 8 week trial period, and actually the produce department at Uptown noticed that organic products sold better when the organic market was there than when the organic wasn't there. And so they were pleased to, or, you know, they were at least reluctantly willing to see that market established. And I think it really does add a lot to our, you know, it makes our place more interesting and a destination for organic food. So it is a win-win situation. It's a win-win situation. And, you know, like Brad said, we do compete with DeMille's, and again, I see DeMille's as a real asset to Salmon Arm. It's incredible. But our produce, you know, the people on the ground see it a little bit differently, because, you know, they have to deal with the competition.
Well, you guys have geographically positioned yourselves very appropriately, one in the east and one in the west. And I know that Brad's store sells a lot of basic produce for people who aren't looking for niche products or boutique materials. They're looking for their daily vegetables, and your store actually supplies a lot of people in the west end of town with their, and all over the community, with their daily vegetables. Would that not be fair to say, Brad? Sorry.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of it is, and especially in these COVID challenged times, I believe that people are staying regionally. They're experimenting with stores that are open and available. And this winter has been amazing to get around. I mean, we've had probably the easiest winter I can ever remember. Here we are, March, what is it, the 4th or 5th today? And all suddenly I think it's April, but it's really not April yet. But I believe that people in this COVID, and this is where the opportunity is shown for a lot of us, is that we're having people in our store that would normally be in Arizona or Texas or Hawaii or Mexico. Some of the older folks that maybe are a little more affluent can afford to say, okay, let's come out and let's try some of these products that maybe you wouldn't have had the economics to try before.
And do you get feedback from people that the quality of fresh food is greater than the quality of food that comes from 5,000 kilometers away?
Well, I think that we're very lucky in BC to have as cheap of imported produce as we have. That certainly can change on a weather's whim or an event. We've been very, very lucky this year. I expected a higher inflation rate on things. And also, it's been pretty easy to get along with the pricing this year. No real big spikes. Even that cold snap in Texas really didn't affect us that much. And I thought for sure that any excuse to put the prices to Canada, because you have expenses, you're going to Canada and coming back largely empty. So you're really paying for fuel and shipping both ways to get
it here. Indeed you are. Yes, indeed. But just that point alone, not just the financial cost of fuel, but the climate-related cost of burning a lot of fuel to transport food and other produce miles and miles and miles, thousands of kilometers, is increasingly something that more and more people are paying attention to, people who buy the food and also people who retail it, as you do. You know that if you get something that comes from 3,000 kilometers away, there's a lot of cost, dollar cost, but there's also a climate-related cost to that.
Absolutely. I mean, the carbon footprint, we all want to reduce it. We love putting fuel in our tanks. I know that. And in Canada, especially right now in BC, we seem to be paying, in my opinion, more than we should. But maybe that cost is also trying to make you deter that cost being induced every day when you get in your car in these hybrids and different ways to do things. But if we can reduce that carbon footprint on anything, I think that's a good direction to head.
David, have looked at the bigger picture because you've spent a considerable amount of time outside the community coming back here with an awareness of both social justice issues and also of environmental issues overall and environmental justice as well. How much does that play into your sense of direction for Askew's Foods?
Well, that's a question out of left field. But
that's where we live, left field.
It's pretty interesting because I guess, being a company that's been around through the Great Depression and so on, there was always a big emphasis on reusing things. And my Uncle David told this story about he was delivering a meat order up Merton Hill, which, as you know, is very, very steep, on his bicycle. And his father said, "Make sure you bring the box back." So my uncle, when he emptied the box, he put it on his handlebars and started down the hill. And David was a speed demon. As he hit the peak speed, the box flew up over his head, so he couldn't see a damn thing. But, with my father, too, I used to pick up the boxes from the liquor store so we could pack groceries in them. One day I did actually find a full bottle in one of those empty boxes, but... we used to get those. I remember the day they told us we won't be getting those boxes anymore because now we're going to recycle them. But, we always have had a really big emphasis. My father installed heat recovery on the refrigeration system in 1967. And I was a chemical engineering. I calculated that the payback period was 13 years. He didn't do it just for the savings in energy, did it because it was an environmentally friendly thing to do. So we've always had that and we stick to selling food. We haven't branched out into other items and so on. I think we've really focused on, and we've retained some of the local suppliers that we've had over the years. So, you know, we might not have quite the connection we do now if we hadn't started so long ago.
Maybe I think you're getting to a point that I think is central as well to local food production and retailing, and that is giving jobs to people. Brad, your business hires quite a number of people. It's over 60 at the peak. Askew's has a large number of employees. And my understanding is that your employees tend to stick around. They don't. So, Brad, maybe you could start off that angle. That when you hire people, I mean, you have younger people, of course, they tend to do like you and many other people have done. You move along to another activity, but nevertheless, you have people who also stay with you for long periods of time.
Well, if you can find a gem these days, and we have an ability, we're a weird place sometimes because there's one job you'll start in the morning, I'll guarantee you're not going to do that same job in the afternoon. So diversity is something that you need to be able to, and flexibility in your job approach. Mm-hmm. You're not going to sit and be a cashier all day long. And this makes it so it's interesting because not everyone gets to clean the luxury of cleaning washrooms. Everyone gets that opportunity. We don't really.
Thank you on behalf of your employees.
Oh, and you know what? We teach them how to clean a toilet, though. And it's a life skill, I'm pretty sure. And you start at the top and work down. You don't go up. We've been able to adapt to these different challenges that you have by keeping it interesting for these young folks. And I've had lots of kids, especially when minimum wage maybe was a little bit more of a training wage, or you know, where you could start them at 14 and all suddenly they're third or fourth year college at 20, 22, and they're off onto their lives. And they've worked for you for 6 or 7 years. I've had some of my employees just like Askew's for many years, like not multiple decades, but certainly a decade and a half when I've been running it. And it's been awesome. And they're part of our family, just like the Askew's chain is, that you have people that you go to that you recognize, just like going in the bar at Cheers and hey Norm, we get those people and they are part of what we do, and it's just you feel like you're appreciated. If nothing else in these world, we just need a good morning. I don't know if you want to ask people how they are because I don't know if we have that kind of time, but certainly you recognize that they're part of your life and that they're a valued asset to what you do.
That's a good point to hold off for a second.
Thank you, Warren. I have a little bit of information concerning contact. Some listeners have requested a contact number to reach Shuswap Food, the Action Society. So if you'd like to contact someone associated with this show, Food Conversations, or our sister show, More Food for Thought, please write down the following information. To contact CKVS, Voice of the Shuswap, you could leave a message for Warren Bell or Steve Corey or anyone else for that matter. You can call 250-463-5026. I say again, 250-463-5026 or email info@voiceofthesushwap.ca. For Shuswap Food, you can go to their website, www.shuswapfood.ca, or send an email to info@shuswapfood.ca. The private phone numbers of our volunteers are not made public. We're all volunteers, as a matter of fact, at CKVS and Shuswap Food, and we welcome your input. Join us. Come and join us. We hope to have some, maybe in the near future, part-time, full-time staff here at the radio station and maybe at Shuswap Food. Then you could just call the office.
Brad was talking a moment ago. You were talking about relationships with your staff. Dave, you work with a large staff on an ongoing daily basis, and you yourself have been part of the staff of Askew's Foods for many years. You know that there are people who come to work for the store and they stay there for a long time. That seems to be part of the tradition with not just with Brad's store, but also with Askew's. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yes, actually, we probably one of the things we pride ourselves on, as Brad does, is that the longevity of our staff. We probably have at any time 10 staff over 30 years tenure with us. Right now we have two over 40 years. And if the math is correct, one of them will make 50 years when he retires, you know. And I think that it goes to show you how we value our staff. You know, we show our appreciation in many ways. We enjoy getting together every 5 years with them as they reach a milestone and thanking them. And, you know, I think they appreciate it. And that also lends itself to knowledge in your stores, you know, and helps us keep competitive. When you've got someone who's been working in the produce department, for example, for 20 plus years, he knows the farm. He knows where that farm is from if he's a local guy or girl, and it can tell you about the family. That lends itself to our customers' trust in us, for sure.
Of course it would. Of course it would. David, has retaining long-term employees been part of the sort of overall ethos, if you like, of Askew's Foods? Has that been something that sort of be built into how you operate?
Yes, it has, and particularly this whole issue of full-time work. So we have tried to maintain as many full-time jobs as we can, and that, you know, means that you have a living income to work to support yourself and your families. And we've put a high priority on that. One of the things that we have is a pension plan and a broad benefits plans. And a few years ago, when my sister and I were working on the company together, we introduced an employer-paid long-term disability plan. We didn't want any of our employees who, through no fault of their own, became disabled during employment, you know, to be without an income. And so we have really stressed, you know, we have stressed trying to give back to the employees. I feel they give more to Askew's than we could, any employer could ask them to give. And we try to reciprocate in that way.
The conversation has turned regularly through this program today around relationships and connections. And I want to, as we veer towards the end of the show, I want to look at the bigger picture about resilient, sustainable work, employment, business, and food, because they're kind of tied up together. I don't know how many of you know a guy named Guy Cormier. Guy Cormier is the president and the CEO of Desjardins Group, which is a very large financial organization in Quebec. They run local kind of banks called Caisse Populaire, which are very much like co-op banks around here. And so this is a guy whose his company's got 47,644 employees, and they manage assets of $282 billion. This is not a guy who's sitting wondering where his next paycheck is coming from. And in an article entitled, "It's Time to Give Capitalism a Do-Over," in the National Observer, it came out 3 days ago, March the 2nd. Here's what he said. One of the things he said, it's the key to the article. He said this: companies that prioritize their communities will ultimately be more sustainable, more resilient, and better set up for long-term growth. Now, here's a guy whose asset base could swallow up the entire province, practically. But what he is saying is that you, Brad, Dave, and David, are doing something that will make you more secure, more resilient, more durable in terms of future vicissitudes, the kinds of things that we've talked about earlier, the market crashes and distributor priorities and that kind of stuff. I'd like each of you to just muse on that and maybe just give your thoughts about what that feels like to you, to feel that you could be in the vanguard of a better way to do things, not just better for the world, which is really nice, but given the fact that you've all had economic challenges, also better for your own businesses. So Maybe I'll start with you, Brad. Just let your thoughts wander a little bit about this perspective raised by this very, very highly placed business person.
Well, I think if you lose sight of the fact that your locals are your power and that your staff is the ability to convert that into success, without those two components, you have really nothing at the end of it. If you have constant turnover of staff, your knowledge base is never there. You are always micromanaging your new people. And if you can do anything for a favor for an employee, is give them the power to make all the mistakes they can. And the only way to correct it is to just the experience of doing it, instead of managing them not to experience a mistake and to be able to recover and to correct it. Whether they correct it 100% like you want them to, that's really not that important. If they get 75% of the way, I consider that a success. And then you bounce around. If you have like-minded people that are bouncing those 75% around, I think you can only be successful, because they're going to own their successes just like they owned their failures to a point, and they'll recognize it before it happens again. Because there's always a difference between if you repeat the same thing over and over again, well, then we might have to step in. But typically, if they have that experience themselves, just like as an owner being challenged with money, those small experiences will define them and make them so much more passionate about what they do.
Very interesting comments, Brad. Dave, you're on the floor, as it were, watching from within Askews, from the core of the working part of Askews. What do you think about this perspective that ultimately companies that prioritize communities will be more resilient, more sustainable, and better set for long-term growth?
I think it definitely shows that you are there for the community when you look at it in that perspective. Like, as far as employees, like Brad alluded to, I'm sure Askews and Brad as well, as a percentage of full-time employees, we show a much, much greater percentage than, say, the big box stores who are perhaps looking to save a dollar on their benefits, et cetera, if they don't give their employees 22 hours a week. When our employees are successful, they are part of the community. They're able to buy houses in the community, shop in the community, get their hair cut, shop the local hardware store. They're not going out of town to seek that cheaper dollar, perhaps, or cheaper purchase. And I think we kind of take a lot of pride in that, as Brad alluded to there.
I'm going to give the last word to David. David Askew, the owner of Askew's Foods. You've got a business that's been embedded in the community for a very long time, and you've seen many changes take place. What's your reaction to this statement by Guy Cormier, the president of and CEO of Desjardins, that businesses that prioritize communities will do better in the long haul these days, the way things are going?
Well, community has been a big part of Askews. Pretty much, I didn't know so much about my grandfather, but certainly my father and my sisters and I, we have emphasized community in the sense that Dave was talking about, where we try to use local community resources, printing, builders, lawyers, accountants. We try to spend all of the money that we can in this local community. And I think that definitely it conveys our interest in strengthening the community. And therefore, I remember we had a focus group when we were looking at Uptown, and one of the participants said, "You support us, so we should support you." And I think that sort of reflected somewhat how people feel about it. I'm very happy now, because back in the day, back in the early days, I think there was a kind of resentment of small businesses that succeeded, and people didn't like to see any changes in the pecking order. Now there seems a broader perspective, and I feel that there is wide community support for local business.
Thank you, David. We're coming to the end of our show. This is the end of Food Conversations with my three guests, Brad DeMille, Dave Wallace, and David Askew. It's been a wonderful show. I thank you all for your participation, and your insights, and my language. 10-4. Nice to talk to all of you again. It's been a great show. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.